We head into the news that you can pledge by phone. That number is 608-256-2001, and Ralph will answer your call, or hop online, wortfm.org/donate.
The time is now 6 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to WORT's local news for Thursday, March 6, 2025. I'm your host, Christina Leffering.
Good evening. I'm your host, Allison Markoski. In tonight's news, nearly 200 Madison ballots were misplaced and left uncounted in the November election, and four voters are now seeking compensation.
An incumbent alder describes his commitment to police oversight.
And in the second half, Oddity Box spreads the word about a local workforce development program. The House Always Wins has more on solar panels, and Radio Chipstone takes a deep breath.
All these and more on tonight's news. But first, we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
BBC News, hello, I'm Eileen McHugh. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says he will travel to Saudi Arabia next week, where Ukrainian and US officials are due to discuss an initial ceasefire with Russia. Leaders of European Union countries have promised to stand by Ukraine and pledged to increase defence spending. Nick Beek is in Brussels.
All 27 EU leaders said they'd look into new plans from the European Commission to offer 150 billion euros in loans to member states for them to expand their militaries and increase weapons manufacturing. But Hungary's Viktor Orban, with his Moscow sympathies, has reportedly refused to sign a joint text pledging continued support for Ukraine. He's argued Europe should now follow Donald Trump's lead, pick up the phone to President Putin and thrash out a peace deal.
President Trump has suspended most of the tariffs imposed on Mexico and some on Canada a day after they came into effect. The Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, said a phone call with Mr. Trump had yielded unprecedented results. Canada said it was delaying its second wave of retaliatory tariffs. Erin Delmore has more details.
We are talking about the goods that are covered by the existing North American trade agreement that was negotiated during President Trump's first term in office. That covers around 50% of imports from Mexico and around 38% of imports from Canada. But if you do the math there, you still see that there's a large chunk of products that will be affected. And again, this is a one-month reprieve. President Trump has warned that on April 2nd, this reprieve will expire. And he's also said that reciprocal tariffs will go into effect on countries that impose tariffs on the United States.
In his first audio message since being hospitalized, Pope Francis has thanked those who have been praying for his recovery. He's been in hospital for nearly 3 weeks with double pneumonia. In the brief message, the Pope sounds breathless as he thanks well wishers from the bottom of his heart. Sudan has launched proceedings at the International Court of Justice against the United Arab Emirates, accusing it of being complicit in the genocide of non-Arab groups in Darfur. Sudan alleges the UAE is providing military and financial support to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. The UAE has described the case as a cynical publicity stunt. Here's Anna Holligan.
Since the conflict erupted almost 2 years ago, both the RSF and the Sudanese army have been accused of committing atrocities. Tens of thousands of people have been killed and more than 12 million displaced, making the situation in Darfur one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. One legal obstacle may stand in the way. The UAE does not consent to ICJ jurisdiction over genocide convention disputes.
This is the world news from the BBC. Clashes have taken place in Syria's coastal province of Latakia between troops controlled by the new Islamist government in Damascus and fighters loyal to the ousted President Bashar al-Assad. Syrian state media say at least 13 government soldiers were killed in heavy fighting and Latakia is now under curfew. Europe has restored its independent access to space with the first commercial mission of the new Ariane 6 heavy lift rocket. After recent days, the rocket launched from the Kourou space base in French Guiana, successfully placing a French spy satellite into orbit. Ariane 6 was meant to enter service in 2020. A lunar lander built by a private US firm has touched down on the moon, but the CEO of Intuitive Machines, Steve Altemus, says it's not landed in the right position. NASA says the six-legged device is sending back data. The lander, called Athena, was expected to touch down near the South Pole and is carrying three rovers and a hopping drone. They're meant to investigate a crater that never sees sunlight. Dr. Simeon Barber, a lunar scientist at the Open University, told the BBC the lander's position could affect the whole mission.
The landers are designed with solar panels which would point at the sun and charge up the rechargeable batteries on the lander. If it's on its side, then those panels are not going to be pointing in the right direction, and therefore the lander's not going to charge its batteries as it should. So it may well have a shorter lifetime than expected or couldn't be powered up fully.
The United States has offered a $10 million reward for a Canadian former Olympic snowboarder who's wanted on charges of drug trafficking and murder. The FBI said Ryan Wedding had gone from shredding powder on the slopes to distributing powder cocaine on the streets of US and Canadian cities. Investigators suspect he may be living in Mexico under the protection of the Sinaloa cartel. BBC News.
This is Christina Leffering and Allison Markowski with your local news coming to you live from the WORT studios in downtown Madison during our pledge drive. Keep your calls coming, and here are tonight's headlines. A handful of Madison voters whose ballots weren't counted last November have initiated a class action lawsuit against the City of Madison and Dane County. The four voters are just some of the 193 voters whose ballots were misplaced and never included in the final tally during the presidential election. And now they're seeking $175,000 each in damages. The voters are represented by the progressive legal firm Law Forward. In a press conference this morning, Law Forward co-founder Jeff Mandel said, "The goal of the lawsuit is to reinforce the fundamental right to vote."
These 193 voters followed the rules. They obtained and cast their ballots, and through no fault of their own, they had their right to vote violated. That right to vote is guaranteed by the Wisconsin Constitution and by case law in our state dating back to the earliest days of statehood.
It would take until December, over a month and a half after the November 5th election, for the city clerk to disclose that some votes weren't counted. And the uncounted ballots stem from two separate instances of missed ballots. One batch of ballots from two wards in downtown and on the near west side were discovered in tabulator bins a week after the election. Another batch of ballots in a primarily student district just down the street from WORT were discovered in absentee carrier envelopes nearly 1 month later. The city says that the votes would not have changed the outcome of any race, but had election officials disclosed the uncounted ballots earlier, at least some could have been included in the final count during the election certification process. Law Forward says it's representing voters with ballots in both batches. Here's Mandel again.
I think on the one hand, it's fair to say that because the ballots were discovered at different times in different circumstances, they are slightly differently situated. But our position is that all of their votes should and could have been counted, even though the state canvass had been conducted by the time that the second batch of ballots was discovered in early December. There was still time to amend that canvass and include all of these votes in the final numbers for the state of Wisconsin.
Meanwhile, the Wisconsin Elections Commission has been investigating the uncounted ballots. A report issued by the commission last week found that Madison clerk Mary Beth Witzel Bell failed to implement procedures that could have caught the ballots in time to be counted. The report also found that Witzel Bell didn't take any actions contrary to state law and did not abuse her discretion. That report is set to be reviewed by the Elections Commission tomorrow. The city is also conducting its own internal investigation. Meanwhile, the Isthmus newspaper reports today that some alders expect Witzel Bell's contract, which expires in the fall of 2026, to not be renewed. That decision is up to Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway.
More details have emerged about the 16 federal offices in Wisconsin that will be closed on orders from billionaire Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, leases on the following federal offices in Madison are being canceled: the Fish and Wildlife Service, 4511 Helgeson Drive; the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, One Point Place; the Federal Highway Administration, 525 Junction Road; the Food and Drug Administration and Departmental Management offices at 740 Regent Street. In addition, leases on a National Labor Relations Board office in Milwaukee, Social Security offices in Wausau and Green Bay, Bureau of Indian Affairs offices in Shawnee and Ashland, an IRS Taxpayer Assistance Center in La Crosse, an Agriculture Department office for rural development in Stevens Point, and a U.S. Attorney's office in Green Bay are slated for termination. In what has become a pattern, some information from Musk's department is unclear or conflicting. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Wisconsin said the order to close its Green Bay office had been rescinded, but it remains on the DOGE list.
President Donald Trump's efforts to dismantle the Federal Department of Education have state education officials bracing for the fallout any changes could bring to Wisconsin, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. According to a draft of an executive order obtained by USA Today, Trump will seek to eliminate the department, quote, to the maximum extent appropriate and permitted by law. Congressional approval would be required to abolish the department completely, so the limits of Trump's power could be tested. One major provision that hangs in the balance for Wisconsin and other states is the billions of dollars in federal aid that the department distributes. Wisconsin relieves $1 billion annually to support just K-12 education alone.
The cost of childcare now outstrips the cost of college tuition and even rent in Wisconsin, an analysis by a pro-union think tank found. The Wisconsin Examiner reports that a study by the Economic Policy Institute concluded that the average annual cost of childcare in the state is $17,000. That compares to an average annual cost to rent an apartment at $13,088 and an average cost of college tuition for an academic year at $9,129. The think tank analyzed childcare costs across the country and found them exceeding the cost of college tuition in 38 states and the District of Columbia. Childcare is more expensive than rent in 17 states and D.C.
Dane County supervisors are slated to consider a resolution tonight, calling on the state legislature to take action on gun reform. Speaking earlier today at the state capitol, County Board Chair Patrick Miles argued that the reforms outlined in the resolution are a common sense first step in the effort to prevent gun violence in our state.
Many reforms have been implemented in other states and have proven to reduce and prevent gun-related deaths. Those reforms include things like extreme risk protection orders, also commonly known as red flag laws, safe storage requirements, and universal background checks. These common sense reforms won't solve all the problems leading to gun violence and deaths. We, for example, at Dane County, are working to address behavioral health needs. But these gun reform tools save lives by taking guns out of the equation when someone is in a moment of mental health crisis or in the heat of a domestic dispute. They create a pause to allow time for a situation to de-escalate.
The resolution also calls on the legislature to repeal a state law that prohibits Wisconsin municipalities from enacting gun regulation on the local level. State Senator Kelda Royce, a Democrat from Madison, urged her Republican colleagues today to consider the reforms or get out of the way.
In 2024, there were 330 school shootings. We've had many instances of gun violence and gun deaths, which are preventable in this state. Just in recent months, we've lost friends to suicide. All of this is preventable. And at a certain point, we have to look ourselves in the mirror and say, if we have the tools to reduce gun violence and deaths, and we choose not to, we are making a policy choice to continue allowing guns to be the number one cause of death for our children, and that is shameful. If government can't help people feel free and safe, what are we doing? My Republican friends, you know, cash their paychecks every single month, and every month they refuse to take action on these overwhelmingly popular bills, and they're also blocking good legislators around the state, like Dane County board members, who want to take action from doing so. They're not willing to do their jobs, and they don't want anybody else to do their jobs either. So, you know, we really call on them to start working for the people who are paying them, or get out of the way and let some of our local leaders take the lead here.
The Republican-held legislature has rejected gun reform proposals in every session since 2019. As one of his first actions in office, Governor Evers called the legislature into special session to take up red flag laws and universal background checks, measures that Republicans ignored. Republicans in the state's powerful budget-writing committee also struck several gun safety measures out of the governor's last biennial budget proposal. His budget proposal for the next 2 years includes those same measures, and should Republicans reject them again, Senator Roy says Democrats are prepared to reintroduce them as standalone bills. A 2022 Marquette Law School poll found that more than three-quarters of registered voters are either very concerned or somewhat concerned about gun violence. And the same poll found that since being introduced in 2019, support for gun safety measures hasn't wavered. A consistent 81% of voters support red flag laws, while 79% support mandatory background checks.
Access to public information and the organizations that have fought to obtain it in the past year are the highlight of the annual OPIE Awards, announced today by the Wisconsin Federation of Information Council. This year's Public Openness Advocate Award, or POPI, goes to the Milwaukee Police Department for expediting release of information on unsolved missing persons cases. More often, though, the awards cite efforts to pry information from reluctant agencies. They include the Citizen Openness Advocate, or COPI, to American Oversight for fighting to obtain records from Michael Gableman's fruitless campaign to find fraud in Wisconsin's 2020 presidential election. The Media Openness Advocate, or MOPI, to the Wisconsin Examiner for its lawsuits against the cities of Wauwatosa and Black River Falls for their improper handling of open records requests. The Open Records Scoop of the Year, or SCOPY, to WTMJ-TV in Milwaukee for its series on Milwaukee police officers with personal issues that compromise their credibility as witnesses. The Whistleblower of the Year, or WHOOPI, to Ted Heath. His claim that Wisconsin Bell overcharged schools and libraries millions of dollars for internet access and other services was validated last month in a unanimous ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the No Friend of Openness, or NOPI, to Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway for criticizing news media for asking too many questions about the December mass shooting at Abundant Life Christian School. Finally, it's been 10 years since Tony Robinson was shot and killed by Madison police officer Matt Kenney. Robinson's killing prompted a series of reforms to Madison's police department over the last decade. Those reforms include the Independent Monitor, Civilian Review Board, and the popular nonviolent emergency responses called CARES. Robinson's family is still calling for justice, maintaining that Kenney should be formally charged, despite DA Ishmael Ozan's decision not to pursue the case. In 2023, Robinson's family filed a complaint to compel a judge to order a special investigation that could result in charges. Robinson would have turned 30 this October, and those calling for justice and accountability that his life was cut short at age 19 are gathering on Willie Street tonight, a decade after his death. As in previous anniversaries, the hub of activity is the Social Justice Center and surrounding businesses. A candlelight vigil is planned to start
right up around now at 6:15 at 1125 Willie, where he was killed. The lineup of events tonight also includes performances at Cafe Coda. Showing at nearby Aubergine is the documentary 19, The Tony Robinson Shooting, A Case of Deadly Bias. Our news team will bring you coverage of tonight's memorial events next week.
You're listening to the live local news on WORT. We turn now to two special guests, Katie Jergala and Vicky Kenyon, in the studio, who want to encourage your support to WORT during the WORT Winter Fundraiser.
Hi, friends. Vicky here.
Katie here.
It's a busy news night, so we're not going to take a bunch of time. We do want to just remind you that it's a pledge drive this week, and you can call and talk to Ralph. He's happy to take your information over the phone. The number is 608-256-2001, or donate online, wortfm.org. Click the orange button.
And now, back to the news.
Incumbent Alder Isidore Knox Jr. is running this spring for his third term on the city council. He faces one opponent in Noah Lieberman, a redux of their matchup in 2023. The election that year resulted in a tie and was decided in Alder Knox Jr.'s favor when his name was pulled out of a bag. Sitting down with WORT news producer Faye Parks, Alder Knox Jr. described his commitment to police oversight efforts and back-to-basics budgeting.
Hello, I'm Isidore Knox Jr., and I've lived in South Madison for over 35 years. My wife, Cheryl, and I have live in a loving, supportive community. We've raised our five kids, who are all college degree professionals now. I'm a retiree of 36-plus years in state and county government as a manager. Then this is actually, I'm finishing my second term as a city alder. I served in 2005 to 2007, and now I'm completing my second term from 2023 to 2025. I love my community. I've served it over those 30 plus years, and I'm very interested in continuing to represent my district residents as well as the city of Madison.
Why run for a third term? What inspires you?
Well, actually, I finished my original term in 07, and, you know, my son was turning 14, so I felt like I needed to pay more attention to my family situation. But recently, when this last term came up, one of my friends, Sherry Carter, used to be our alderperson for 8 terms. They redistrict her neighborhood to another district. And so when that happened, we were trying to think of who is the person that knows our community well, has represented our community on civic boards and commissions and community issues. And I just felt like I was the person that had the experience, the knowledge of government over the years, and more importantly, knowing my community and what their needs are. So I decided to run for office again.
What is one specific achievement that you drove forward in your latest term on the council?
I serve on the Commission on Aging, and as we were doing our budget this year, late in October, on this commission, we have about $800,000+ for the aging population services. So we were experiencing a 40% cut in one of the large agencies that provide for senior services. But the good thing was we were also adding several other agencies to provide services, particularly to the BIPOC community. So as we start having the hearings, I heard a couple of African-American people I know who were talking about worried about losing their senior services that they were receiving. And then, of course, we heard quite a bit from other seniors about the large agency losing 40% of their budget. So myself and Mike Revere, we were kind of having a conversation about it doesn't seem like there's adequate services for seniors. We decided not to support the original staff recommendation and then put it off to the next month. We talked to a lot of the stakeholders. Once we did that, we were able to come back the next month, leverage over $100,000 of additional money targeted for specifically case management for the BIPOC community. And we felt like that was a win-win because we were able to support the staff's recommendation and at the same time add additional resources and target those senior individuals who may have not been receiving services or making sure that they continue receiving services. I felt really good about that recent budget recommendation.
What is one policy in your latest term that you tried to get accomplished but didn't?
Oh, that's easy. That's the body-worn camera for our Madison Police Department. We did do a pilot that's been completed. I think the results indicate that it's time for the city of Madison to join other cities of our size in making sure that we promote body-worn cameras. So that's going to be one of my priorities for the upcoming term, to make sure that justice is being served for all residents.
Housing is perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. It impacts everyone, from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job, paying about $28 per hour or $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
We really need to look at how is Madison as a community going to be able to provide the workforce housing, as well as all types of housing that we're going to need, particularly with the projections that we've been given regarding our population increasing. I think that the city of Madison has done some good things, trying to add additional resources to the Affordable Housing Fund, which we're going to need, utilizing land banking opportunities in hopes that we can find places to develop to increase our housing. But quite frankly, we're behind. The real key is to have workforce housing where people who are working in the city can afford to pay their rent or maybe even get a mortgage. I live in a district that happens to have probably the lowest percentage of single-family housing in the city. And that's important to the stability of our neighborhoods. Where we need affordable housing, we also need opportunities for people to get into ownership.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes again?
I'm one of the few individuals that did not support the referendum. And I didn't support it because I believe we need to find a more balanced approach to prioritizing the budget and making sure that first priority would be essential services that we need to provide. It's appropriate to look at how do we utilize the contingency fund, or what we call the rainy day fund, and not go below the 15% to keep our bond rating at AAA, but use those resources from those additional revenues. Maybe we could find some savings and some efficiencies internal to the city. There are probably departments that could share different resources that they're doing similar things. But I'm really concerned about us continuing to raise taxes, continuing to add user fees. So I would look at, there are some essential things that we do have to pay for, but there are other things that might be a luxury that our city can no longer afford.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Olders have two priorities, to their constituents and their districts, and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
You just described one of the most difficult things that we have to do as an alder. We have to support our constituents, but also we have the whole city's trust at our disposal. I listen carefully to what my constituents are saying to me and experiencing. And I try to look at that situation and figure out a way how we can make things better for my constituents. But keeping in mind, we have to look at the whole city sometimes and make a decision. What's in the best interest of the whole city? And hopefully find ways you can have impact for your individual constituents.
Incumbent Alder Isidore Knox Jr. is running for re-election this spring. He'll face one challenger on April 1st in Noah Lieberman. You can learn more about Alder Knox's re-election campaign on his website, electisidoreknox.com.
It's now 6:29 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We turn now to two special guests in the studio, Katie Gergela and Vicky Kenyon, who want to tell you a little something about the WORT pledge drive.
In lieu of the BBC this evening, we're coming to you live from Madison with a bit of a report. We are here with WORT as part of the 2025 Winter Pledge Drive, and we have a new donor. Zoe from Madison has kindly become a new monthly donor. Something really cool about being a new donor for this pledge drive is that all donations from new donors or lapsed donors, which is anyone who has not donated in the past year and a half, your donation will be matched by a very generous donor.
Thanks, Zoe. We appreciate you chipping in. Lovely, lovely. Hey, I want to talk real quick about what happens to put a nightly news show together locally. We have all kinds of news writers, Sutton and Greg and Russ and Faye and Shally and so many others who I haven't met yet are writing the news all day long, and they upload a script for news readers, Christina and Allison and Marcus, and we do our best to bring that to you every night. Thanks for hanging in there with us. We're going to give you more pledge drive info a little bit later.
And we'll head back to the news.
Thanks, Katie and Vicky. You're pledging to handcrafted, artisanal, live and local news here on WORT 89.9 FM. There's more coming up, so keep your calls coming, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Randy, a longtime WORT listener and an Evergreen donor. This year, I will be donating to WORT through my IRA. To lessen my tax impact, I can make a donation to WORT. And this might even lower my Medicare premiums and put me in a lower tax bracket. If you are 70 and a half or older, you can do this too. Why did I decide to include WORT for part of my RMD distributions? Well, it's easy. It's the music. WORT has opened my ears to music I don't hear anywhere else. Donating to WORT is my way of saying thanks to this local treasure. To learn more about RMD donations, visit the donation page on WORTFM.org or email Susan at WORTFM.org. Happy 50th, WORT.
Time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the local news on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. I'm your host, Christina Leffring, here with my co-host, Allison Murkowski. Thank you for joining us tonight on the 6 p.m. local news.
Action Jackson is the CEO of Jackson's Yard Care, a self-funded workforce development program that offers free training and certification in landscaping. Continuing his conversation with Oddity Box host D-Star, Jackson shares how he's overcoming language barriers to make sure that his program is accessible to everyone.
So it's 4 weeks, and they get two certifications, and at the end of that, you either employ them or help them get employed with a company, correct?
And don't get this wrong, not everybody gets placed, right? Because what we're looking for, this program is meant to teach you the trade and the opportunity for employment. If you coming into this program and you're not putting in your participation, then we're not going to be backing you trying to put our name, our reputation on the line and wasting time. Just go ahead and get your knowledge about the industry and then do what you need. But if you're not giving us your full participation, and if you're not jumping in there and really trying to get to that next level, because the next level is the job. The next level is the placement. So we really need those people to understand this is a program to teach you to trade. You want to go to that next level, then go in there with your head screwed on straight.
It's funny that you say that about placement and things like that. You know, it's a lot of things that's going on in the world. And when you're talking about the migrant situation, for the last couple of graduations, you've actually had people from Venezuela in your program that took the entire program, graduated from the program, and you've actually placed them. So can you tell us a little bit about what that was like? Because I know you had to get an interpreter. You had to, you know, you had to go the extra mile for that. So can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
Man, I think that was one of the toughest things about what I had to do to kind of piece this thing together, because it was the language barrier. They couldn't speak English at all, period. And yeah, we did have an interpreter, but it was a good thing for us that some of our students in the class knew how to speak English and Spanish. But we had a bundle of them. I had at least, in my second program course, we had at least 7 students that couldn't speak no English.
Right. That was from Venezuela, right?
They were scattered around from different places. And that was
Mexico,
the other.
Venezuela.
Yeah, and that was the other challenging thing, too.
Because some of them spoke Portuguese, right?
Right. So I had to figure out ways around that. And a lot of things that came across was hand signaling and then, like, breaking off people's in groups so we can get that attention span. But the crazy thing about all of that is majority of them we did place. And they did turn out pretty good. Some of them completed actually the second course, because we got the snow plowing course as well.
And yeah, that's another thing. There's 2 courses. So there's a lawn care and landscaping course, and then there's a snow removal course also. Both free, open to the public, and you've had men and women, and you've had disabled people also.
Yeah. I just want to kind of make it clear what's the mission and what's the vision behind the program. It's not all about making an employee. It's all about making our community great. What we focus on is, yes, we want to get people in placement for employment, but what we want to is just shed the knowledge of our industry for people to use it at their own will. Like, it's so easy for somebody to go out there and make a couple bucks on their own block with a push mower and some basic lawn tools. But to have the experience to actually know about what they're doing, it's a total different ballgame.
Absolutely. Yeah, just like we were just talking about the podcast. Like, people want to start a podcast, that's great, but do you actually know what you're doing?
Right.
You know, like, can you troubleshoot? If there's a problem, can you fix it? You know, because there's nobody to fix it, you know, like,
it's only you.
It's only you. So you can, I was having a conversation earlier and I was like, you can have all the best equipment in the world, but if you don't know how to use it,
it's
worthless. You can get a guy with a $200 camera and you got a $10,000 camera. The end product might look way better with his because he knows what he's doing. He knows the settings. He, you know what I mean? He's comfortable. He's got his own workflow. You know what I'm saying? So,
no, I totally,
you know, it's not all about the information. It's actually you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have to, your ability to soak that up to, you know, and to execute.
That was Out of the Box host D Star sitting down with Action Jackson, the CEO of Jackson's Yard Care.
We turn now to Katie Dragella and Vicky Kenyon, who want to tell us a little something about how your support makes the local news happen during our pledge drive.
Yes, we are here as part of the 2025 pledge drive for winter. If you want to, before we even get into it, I'm going to let you know, you can go ahead and call 608-256-2001 or go online to wortfm.org to help us out here at the station.
So we also want to say a huge thanks to Just Veggies for feeding all of us tonight. The pad thai was pretty good, yeah?
Very good. Last night they gave us spaghetti. This night is pad thai. I believe there's a vegetarian and a vegan option. So
yes,
we're super grateful to them.
Thank you so much, Just Veggies, for feeding us. We love you.
We also love the local news here at WORT. We didn't have too much of a chance to get into it during our last break, but we want to talk about how many people are actually involved in getting the news on air. I think if you're a listener, it's pretty easy to forget how many people are working behind the scenes other than just the 2 or 3 people you hear on air. There's a news director, there's a news producer, there's people who are working on the equipment that we bring out into the field for interviews, there's people coordinating the interviews, there's people writing headlines, there's people engineering the board and making things actually play on the air. So other than just the other than who's reading the headlines and who you're hearing on air, there's so many people that are involved and so much equipment that gets used just to produce 1 hour of news every day.
There's a newsroom downstairs with six or seven working stations at it. And I've been in that room before when all the working stations are full and one or two people are recording in the booth or recording phone interviews, editing them, and getting everything ready so that Christina and Allison or whoever that night's hosts are can read those headlines to you. It takes a lot of work, and it takes working equipment, field recorders, soundboard, all those things. And those things can be maintained and continue to work well when we have pledge drives and we can raise money to take care of those types of things.
Yeah, we were able with previous pledge drives to finally afford a new soundboard, which has been hugely helpful. We had a volunteer who was kind enough to 3D print Braille labels on the soundboard so that we are more accessible as a station, as well as we have an elevator here and it doesn't always work the best. So we're trying to maybe upgrade it and repair it to maintain accessibility for all people here at the station.
This station is run almost completely by volunteers. There are seven people who are paid staff here. There are hundreds of volunteers who make this place work, and we want everyone in the community who wants to be able to be a part of WORT to be able to do that. So one way that you can do that without having to actually come down here and hang out with us is to hop on the phone. The number to call to donate to the pledge drive is 608-256-2001, or you can hop online, wortfm.org, and hit that bright orange donate button that has a little heart in it, because we love you. If you call the station right now, for the next 20 minutes, Katie Jergella will answer the phone in the British accent that you just heard her talk.
We would like your money. Something really exciting about this pledge drive is that for every new donor or lapsed donor, if you have not donated in the past year and a half, we have someone who is willing to match your donation. So if you feel like, oh, I can donate a few dollars, but at that point it's not even worth it. Yes, it is. Your money will be doubled and every dollar counts. So again, that's 608-256-2001 or go online at wortfm.org. But for now, we're going to take it back to the news.
Thanks, guys, and please keep your pledges coming as we go back to local news and commentary. Last time on The House Always Wins, we learned about solar PV systems and how they work on your house. For more on renewable energy and possible careers in the field, we continue our conversation with master electrician Joel Shoemaker. Let the electrons flow. I call it housework, cause it's light work. What you gonna do? I'ma throw shapes,
filling the bass till my feet hurt. Hey! I call it housework. Hello, I'm John, and welcome to The House Always Wins, where you learn cool stuff about your house. Last session, we talked with Joel Shoemaker, a master electrician and instructor for the college, about solar PV systems that you might be able to add to your house and how they work. And if it's something you're interested in, you can go to WORT's website and catch that. Today, we're going to continue the conversation with Joel. He's still with us here about if you're interested in something like this and you think that solar is really cool and you want to actually get your hands on some solar panels and maybe even start learning a lot more about it, what your options are. So tell me, Joel, there are people who are like, gosh, this is kind of cool. I want to learn more about this and I want to learn how it works. You know, tell me a little bit about like some of the classes and what you learn at the college.
We have a renewable energy certificate, and we have a number of classes that teach specifically about solar. One that introduces the technology and helps people to learn how to design a system, how to assess a particular location, or whether a system will work well there. And then we also have a class on installing systems. So we have an amazing outdoor laboratory that students can put together and take apart systems so that they can learn right what it takes to install systems. And we also, in the last year, have started a class on batteries.
Right? Wow.
So this is the way the industry is going to add batteries. And we have now both a class on the technology as well as a class on the installation.
So that's a class that anybody can take. You don't necessarily have to be in any program in the college.
Anyone can sign up for these classes.
As you talked about the first class, that one is a little more academic, right? That's sitting down and you kind of learn about how the electrons flow, how the systems work. I did take it and I loved the class because you can actually bring your own roof in and you can essentially design a system for your house. It's not as much hands-on. It's definitely more academic and learning about solar systems, yeah? Then tell me a little bit about the hands-on class. You got your hands on the panels and you're like plugging things in and stuff. Tell me about that.
So we have a number of systems that are relatively small, but they're full-size working systems. We have them on mock roofs at our Commercial Avenue campus. So students come over a weekend typically and install two or three of these systems, put them together and take them apart. So they learn by doing more than one system, right? They're learning how a variety of these different systems work and are put together. But yeah, we do it in a concentrated way, typically on the weekend, so people who are working can still take the class.
So could someone take that and then potentially go and put their own rooftop system in after learning all that?
Perhaps.
Yes and no. Yeah, because there's the aspect of a panel, right? And when you get into the panel, that's not stuff for novices, right?
Yeah, when you're saying the panel, you mean the electrical panel.
Yes,
in
the
house.
Electrical panel in the house. Right, because there's solar panels. Which panel you want?
It depends partly on how comfortable people are with some of the things that, right, are more risky, like you say, working in the electrical panel in their house, working on a rooftop, carrying and moving around large objects, not super heavy, but, you know, large. And there's some very important safety considerations. We do talk about them in the class. We do cover, right, how to be safe. My only hesitation is I wish we taught more, right? These are definitely introductory classes.
So taking the classes really informs you, kind of teaches you a lot about it. You still might end up, you know, maybe hiring someone to come put the system in. But with that knowledge, you can really be a much better consumer.
You can be more clear about what it is that you are wanting to achieve and whether a proposal from some electrician or contractor is actually going to meet the needs that you're identifying.
You know, this leads to another conversation with, are there careers out there for people to do this for a living?
Absolutely, John. In clean energy, both solar and wind, we're seeing these are some of the fastest growing occupations in the country. We see this in Wisconsin as well. There are definitely careers to be had. And sometimes we focus just on the installation, but there's careers in everything surrounding the industry, from design to legal aspects to financing, just a lot of things around the whole industry, in addition to the installation.
When I think about it and think about a job, every solar panel that you would install is that much less coal or gas being burned. Is there any job that would have a greater impact on our environment than being a solar installer, right?
This is definitely one of the things that attracts people to the industry is they feel good about the work that they do. They feel like they're really making a difference. Let me just say one other thing, John, for people who are interested in this. There is a really neat tool called the Solar Career Map. They did a survey of the industry. It's a few years old now, but they did a survey of the industry and it shows like jobs in all the different aspects, from manufacturing to project management to installation, all different jobs across the industry. And you can see what the typical pay and training is for those jobs, where are the sort of entry level jobs, and then what do they lead to. It's a great tool if someone's interested in finding out what the possibilities are for jobs in the industry.
That's awesome. I think that's all we have time for today. So on behalf of Allie, who is off on assignment, and myself, and Joel, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time. But I'm gonna throw shade if I don't get paid for this housework.
I call it housework. Looking for a few minutes of peace? Feature contributor Jennifer Fields has you covered with this archival edition of Radio Chipstone, featuring the soothing voice of historic farmer Dick Hildebrandt and his amazing rope machine. Close your eyes and breathe deeply.
Everyone needed rope. Every farm had one of these because they'd just make their own when they needed it. Plus, it was also done in an industrial scale. Think of sailing ships had miles of rope on them. This style of machine, which, and it was sort of like building a better mousetrap. Everyone had one. But this technology is attributed to Leonardo da Vinci. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But so it goes way, way back in this country. I mean, patents go back to like 1807 as the earliest patent or earliest reference to a patent I could find. The raw material we start with is baler twine. If we were making that from scratch, we would take plant fibers and then spin them, like you would spin yarn on a spinning wheel out of wool. You would spin that into a thin rope. And then the thing is, when you do spin like that, the fibers have a twist, like a corkscrew twist to them. And that twist runs throughout the entire length, you know, of the strand. When you take those strands, put them on our rope machine, and then you start turning the crank on the machine, all those strands start twisting together, but they're twisting opposite the way their twist is. So the reason the rope, when it's done, does not fall apart is the rope is twisted. The six strands are twisting one way, but each of the six strands is also twisting the opposite direction. And those two things twisting against each other mean neither of them goes anywhere. That's how it works. I've seen versions of this machine that are like 8 feet tall and sit on railroad tracks. These are about 10 feet apart, which will make a rope about 7 feet long. So you start out with a small rope. The fibers are twisted, and you have to string the machine, basically. And we're doing six strands. We're running the strands between the cranking end of the rope machine. I'm sure there's an official name for it. And then to the weight on the other side. And what you have to do is basically, this end has these hooks which turn and a crank on it. So that twists these ropes into the bigger one. And there has to be tension on it, which is why there's weights here. We've strung six strands onto three different hooks. And you'll see when we turn the crank, basically what we do is we start twisting these strands tighter and tighter and tighter. And when we get them to the correct tension, then as we loosen the tension, it'll take these six strands and twist itself into one new rope. This is called a rope wrench, and all it does is it keeps the strands from twisting in the beginning. Because first you want to put some tension on these before they twist themselves into one rope. And it also, you'll see when we make the rope, this as we let the tension off with this, with the rope wrench, it'll turn, that's when it twists itself into the other one. We're twisting six strands of rope into three, and then we'll take those three, we'll twist themselves into one. And if you see, as we're twisting these, the strands get shorter, okay? As they get shorter, they lift this weighted bucket up. And the weights are there just to keep tension on it all. Then, now, what we're gonna do is keep twisting, and this is the walking part of the rope walk, and I'll just walk this rope wrench down. You see, as we just walk it down, it twists itself into a rope. The slower I go, the more stiff the rope will be. The faster I go, the less stiff. Consistency is the thing. You want to move it at a constant speed so that the rope has got the same strength throughout the whole thing. And there we go. Honestly, rope making does not fascinate the majority of the people in the world. But I think it's one of those things where it's something that's very simple. It's rope. Who thinks about rope? You know, it's something you buy. We had about 100 feet of rope donated by one of the garden volunteers. He came and said, this was in the barn. It's like 100 years old. I wouldn't trust it, but it's in good shape. And it was. It's been oiled over the years. And so we'll use it. I mean, I wouldn't lift anything with it because it's very old. But it's very nice looking. So we'll use it when we have like our threshing machine set up and we need to string a rope around it to sort of make so the visitors can't come past. And we'll use that rope for that because, you know, it'll be perfectly functional. But yeah, if you take care of it, and all depends on the use too. But if you take care of it, yeah, they'll last years. Don't leave it in the sun. Don't let it get wet. A lot of times rope would be oiled. It would not like dipped in oil, but you know, with maybe oil rubbed over it, and that just makes it a little more waterproof. Don't drag it through the dirt. If dirt gets in a rope, little pieces of stone are stronger than the plant fibers, so they'll slowly eat away and weaken it. Rope wasn't made to last. Rope was made to be used up, which is why you needed a rope machine, because you had to have new rope all the time. It's not a throwaway item, as we think of throwaway items, but no, rope was made to be used. You always take care of the rope no matter what it's being used for. And, you know, we could easily use rope a dozen times a day. It all depends what we're doing.
That was author and historic farmer Dick Hildebrandt demonstrating his amazing rope machine. Jennifer Fields is an art historian, a material culture contributor, and curator of our Radio Chipstone series. She is also the host of Refrangible, available wherever else you get your podcasts. The project is hosted by the School of Human Ecology and the Center of Design and Material Culture at UW-Madison and funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
It's now 6:54 p.m. and you're listening to Handcrafted Local News on WORT. Our guests this evening, Katie Jergella and Vicky Kenyon, have one last word this evening and hopefully some people to thank. So what's the news, Katie and Vicky?
Thanks, Christina and Allison. We love listening to your news on Thursday nights. Yep, we're in the middle of a winter pledge drive. Well, actually, sort of towards the tail end of the winter pledge drive. Thanks, everyone. We've got one donor this hour. Zoe was a new donor, and we had a new donor the last hour from Matt. And the great thing about this winter pledge drive is that new donors and those who have been lapsed in donation for 18 months or longer are having their donations matched. So you can double your impact by donating during this pledge drive. To donate, give us a call here at the station. The number is 608-256-2001, or you can donate on our app. There's a little orange donate button up at the top right. Same donate button that you'll find on the website, wortfm.org.
We had, as Vicky mentioned, one of our two donors in the past couple hours was an evergreen donor. Zoe was a new donor and also an evergreen donor, which is super helpful to us because evergreen donors allow us to better budget what our income will be for the year. And it's easy on you as well. You can just plug in your bank information and you don't even have to think about it. The money just comes out of your account each month and goes to us to help us better our community. If you are looking for outside of the warmth you will feel personally when you donate to WORT, if you're looking for a little bit more, we do have a good amount of thank you gifts this pledge drive.
Yeah, so speaking of warmth and dryness, we could have used this last night. If you donate $7.50 a month, you will receive this fabulous Wart Shed Rain Umbrella. It's super cool. I don't know how to describe it properly, but it kind of closes inside out so that the water doesn't get on you. It's beautiful. It's a very neat looking umbrella too. I saw one in the office here. So that's at the $90 level or $7.50 a month. So if you do an evergreen donation, which is a monthly donation like Katie was talking about, you can still qualify for some really cool stuff. I'm kind of eyeing these House of Marley headphones. They're totally limited quantity. You have to do this one, qualify for this one by donating online, but it's $12.50 a month, and that is a sweet set of headphones.
So if you are looking for any of these thank you gifts, you can give us a call at 608-256-2001. We're looking for about two more donors this hour, or you can head online to wortfm.org. I think we're going to take it back to the news to wrap it up. But again, we appreciate all your support and we look forward to hearing from you.
Keep those calls coming at 608-256-2001 and keep those web donations coming too at wortfm.org/donate. Thanks for supporting the WORT Live Local News at 6 p.m. Your headline writer this evening was Russ Mackey. Special thanks to feature contributors Dee Starr, John Stephanie, and Ali Barini, and Jennifer Fields. Engineer Nicole Alley got the news on the air, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Sholly Pittman is the news director at WORT.
Thanks, I'm your host, Allison Markoski. Up next is live edition of the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a wonderful evening.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bernie's Rock Shop, located at 901 East Johnson, and our new shop, Bernie's on Park, at 636 South Park in Madison. We offer handmade silver jewelry as well as unique mineral, crystal, and fossil specimens from around the world. Store hours and more information available at berniesrockshop.com.
WORT Madison.
Bom dia, Madison. The Hanfibians are proud to present Madison Carnival 2025, Saturday, March 8th, live at the Majestic Theater.
Join us as we celebrate 25 years of Carnival in Madison with an evening of Brazilian drumming, dance, and culture.
The night will showcase the vibrant rhythms of the Hanfibians community bateria and the high-energy performances by Ochimo Dance and Madison Capoeira.
The event will also feature performances by bands from our samba community. Grupo Balança, Samba Novistas, Madison Choro Ensemble, Saideira Pagode, and more.
That's the Madison Carnival 25th anniversary, March 8th at the Majestic Theater.
More information at madisoncarnival.com.
Bringing you the rich culture and music of Brazil, this is WORT Madison.
And welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Catherine Garvins. On tonight's show, I will be speaking with Charlie Carlin of